out. What's wrong?
It's dark.
All right, there we go.
Dasher, Dancer, Prancer, Vixen, Comet, Cupid, Donner, and Blitzen.
Hold on now, don't you recall the greatest reindeer of them all?
Who?
Well, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Linoleum knife.
That was anticlimactic.
No, the first part was really the part you wanted people to hear.
I suppose.
Because it was so great.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I could probably never hear the song Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer again for the rest of my life. But
you better not hear Mary J. Blige.
I'm fixing to say, I have just this year, just now, this week, in fact, been introduced to the Mary J. Blige version,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of groovy, and to this old Ray Conniff singers version from the 50s, which is also kind of groovy.
Very groovy.
I guess I'm going to have to give Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the song, another think.
I guess you will have to stop calling him names.
I watch the special every year.
Yes.
But that's in the context of Rankin Bass,
right?
Stop motion animation, which I can never get enough of.
And also, that's a Christmas special that is steeped in gay subtext, but that's a discussion for another time.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a... You know how this morning we were driving to the mall and having the conversation about how Baby It's Cold Outside is about date rape,
uh-huh.
and how trite an observation that was.
Ditto for Rudolph.
Ditto for Rudolph as the gay subtext.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Welcome.
And every year I hear the same thing over and over and over again about that special and Baby It's Cold Outside.
So let's,
and I'm like, is there a single person who doesn't know this
let's,
yet?
Let's put a Christmas fork in both of them. They are the electric boogaloo of the holidays.
This is Linoleum Knife.
It is.
This is a podcast about movies. We are actual film critics.
On over sometimes for we, and about the cinema.
We don't sometimes always act
like them.
More me than you. But I'm Dave White. I'm the film critic for movies.com.
And I'm Alonzo Duraldi, the film critic for therap.com and for What the Flick on YouTube on the Young Turks channel.
And there's a million things.
Yes.
We have a million things.
A lot to cover this
There's
week.
So many things.
Today, while we were at the mall today.
We went to the mall.
We went down to Costa Mesa, to South Coast Plaza.
Yeah, went to Richie Rich Mall.
Yeah, the malliest of malls. There is a section of the mall that I call Security Guard Row. Because there are dudes in blazers looking, giving everybody the fisheye.
Uh-huh.
Because there's this one stretch where it's like Van Cleef and Arpels and Hermes and the Diptyque store.
Right.
And, you know,
Chanel and
yeah, it's all
Ferragamo
it's
and,
super schmancy. Yeah. This mall, I mean, it's got a Mrs. Fields in there somewhere too, but it definitely has.
It does have a Mrs. Fields in there.
It has some schmancy areas. Oh, hooray! Okay,
and I found the coffee bean with the cocoa.
Mm.
I found those places.
Good. But anyway, while we were doing our sort of last-minute holiday shopping and enjoying the throngs and the bell choirs and all the other things
that bell choir was pretty dope.
They were really great. I love a good bell choir. And it's like it's the end of Scrooge when the bell choir pops up. That's one of my favorite parts.
It's mine too, actually, at the end of Scrooge when the bell choir jumps into the street.
Yeah, because they're leaping. They're
jumping around.
I mean, these people were standing still, so it wasn't as exciting as the one in Scrooge. But they were still pretty great. From the St. John's Episcopal Church in Orange County.
Jones Lutheran Church.
I thought it said
Orange. No, Lutherans.
I swear the sign said Episcopal.
You are swearing wrongly.
Fine. Anyway, St. John's in Orange County. You've got a pretty good bell choir there, and they also had these things that were sort of like it was kind of like hand xylophones, except you only have one key and one mallet. You know the way like each bell plays a one different note.
Right.
Everybody had these little hand. They literally looked like the key of a xylophone with a little mallet attached, and each of them had one of those too, and so they could
interesting.
They could do a full scale or whatever. You know.
I didn't stop and notice that.
Yeah, they were pretty groovy.
I was really into the gigantic bells. The guys.
Yes, the huge gigantic like kettlebells. Yeah. You could barely hear. They were just sort of giving a
mm-hmm.
underneath. You know. Anyway, while we were at the mall, everyone died. It's crazy.
Yeah.
I got on I'm looking at Twitter, and I find out over the course of a few hours, Peter O'Toole, dead. Tom Laughlin, a.k.a. Billy Jack.
Laughlin or Laughlin?
I'm not sure. I've always heard Laughlin.
I always heard Laughlin.
Well, Billy Jack is dead. I found out a couple days ago, Audrey Totter.
I didn't know Billy Jack was still alive.
I sort of honestly, knew that. Audrey Totter, who I did not think was alive, who was starring in a lot of film noir, including my Christmas favorite, Lady in the Lake, dead. And now...
How old?
She was in her, like, 95. She was like in the motion picture home. Joan Fontaine. And it's funny, when I was, I had the rap asked me to write something about Peter O'Toole, and I was sort of kicking around different leads in my head. And one of them was like, you know, how we've pretty much lost the sort of golden age of Hollywood almost entirely. I mean, like, Mickey Rooney is still around, and Joan Fontaine and
Olivia. How old is Mickey Rooney now?
110, as you would say. Joan Fontaine and Olivia de Havilland, my joke has always been those two are never going to die because nobody, none of them wants to die first.
Right.
They're sisters, and they've legendarily feuded for decades and decades. And so I just thought they were going to each stay alive because they knew whoever went first, the other one was going to get the last word on whatever happened in their lives.
And now it's Olivia de Havilland. Now it's Olivia de Havilland. Story to tell.
Yeah, Joan Fontaine, we have lost her. So I'm gonna jump the gun and do my video picks for this week, my DVD picks. I got two. One is for Peter O'Toole, and, you know, as you'll see in the piece, if you go to therap.com and read my article, which you should, I didn't want to be the millionth film critic to wax rhapsodic about Lawrence of Arabia. You know, and my favorite year, and The Ruling Class, and The Stuntman, and all those movies. So
you know those movies.
Yeah, and I knew there were tons of people who were going to tell you everything you need to know about them. So I decided to go for the lesser-known, lesser-loved Peter O'Toole movies. I threw in Goodbye, Mr. Chips, because I figured there were going to be at least one obit that sort of sniffed at it, and I've always kind of liked that movie. But he was in 2005's Lassie, which is a film that I wrote about for the book, for Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas.
A film that will break you in half.
It is a great tearjerker for kids and families.
Almost too much to bear.
Well, but at least it has an up ending.
But yes.
Boy, it puts you through the ringer to get there.
It has an up ending that still makes you bawl crying.
Mm-hmm.
And to get to
best kind.
To get to the happy ending that makes you cry, you have to go through 9 circles of doggy hell.
Yeah, Lassie literally travels through Scotland and all the way down the UK to get back to England.
And there's like
to the boy who loves her.
There's a moment where the boy has to say goodbye to Lassie in the beginning of the movie. That's it is against the Geneva Convention. Yeah,
it is a very, very powerful film, but lovely and wonderful, and Peter O'Toole is in it, and so that's one of his last great movies, I think, and so that's one of my picks this week. And then I also want to recommend for Joan Fontaine, people immediately think about her two collaborations with Alfred Hitchcock, Rebecca and Suspicion. But I got to go with a Letter from an Unknown Woman, which is heartbreaking.
I haven't seen that one.
She plays a young woman who is seduced by Louis Jourdan, who plays this sort of callow concert pianist. And she basically devotes the rest of her life to him, and he barely knows that she exists. And the film is the course of him sort of figuring out.
Helicopter. Here comes the helicopter.
I know. Him figuring out who she was and what her life was about, and it's, oh God, you thought Lassie was upsetting. This movie really will, it cuts deep.
Oh, I'll watch it.
But it's great. So Letter from an Unknown Woman, I highly recommend. That's my Joan Fontaine DVD pick this week.
Do you want me to do my DVD pick right away and get it out of the way?
No. We can do yours at the end.
All right.
I don't know what to say about all these people, except they were awesome in their own very, very different ways.
And they were all old.
But they all made an impact. And
so it's not like a Paul Walker thing where you're like, ah, you know, like.
Right.
You know,
have we suddenly talked about Paul Walker? That happened since last week?
Did it happen right after we recorded?
No, because we talked about it on What the Flick last week. So it must have. I think it happened last week. We didn't talk about it.
I don't remember.
Anyway, so yeah, so it's been crazy body count of movie people lately, and all this and the four that happened this weekend all happened after TCM posted their in memoriam reel for 2013. I remember thinking that's early. This is early December, guys. There's more to come.
December is a month of death.
Apparently, yeah. I don't know what that's about, but.
A knock away.
But Peter O'Toole is great, and all four of them, it is sad they're gone. But Peter O'Toole especially, I think, especially because, as has been pointed out frequently, never won that Oscar.
Really?
Got an honorary one, but never nominated, I think, like 8 times or something, never won. Again, if you want evidence as to why the Oscars are stupid and pointless, Peter O'Toole never won one.
You think that Tom Laughlin thinks it's kind of rad that he's in the same, week of death as Peter O'Toole? It's like, yeah, validity,
He's probably upset that he's getting usurped.
I don't know. I don't think that many people would be talking about him if it weren't for all these other deaths at the same time.
Maybe. I mean,
because he was a momentary thing.
Yeah,
and then went away. He was very much of his moment and then went away.
Like he had a few early screen roles, really kind of made a big impact, late 60s, early 70s, in that sort of post Easy Rider era. Actually, a real, as long as we're talking about him, I think a real pioneer of independent film.
Well, yeah.
Made movies.
Those Billy Jack movies were all his.
Yeah, he made those things. Yeah. People did not want to back him. He got them made, he got them into theaters. And they made money. They made huge amounts of money in the 70s.
Yes.
I think Trial of Billy Jack got yanked by the distributor early on, but Laughlin sort of kept it. I guess it is Laughlin. Kept it going and opened it in smaller markets and stuff, and it became a huge, huge hit. So in a lot of ways, as much as John Cassavetes, I think Tom Laughlin is a real inspiration for today's indie filmmakers as far as, getting around the standard mode of film distribution and getting your work out there and getting it seen and striking a chord with the public, even if in a lot of cases, I think critics were not fans of his stuff.
He violenced his way to fame.
Yeah, well, it was part violence, but I think part also his kind of crackpot conspiracy theories that hit in that post-Watergate sweet spot, and they really, resonated with audiences.
Yeah.
To a point, Billy Jack Goes to Washington, I think, barely ever got seen, but Billy Jack and the Trial of Billy Jack were huge, huge hits.
Uh-huh.
So let's move on to this week. We have a lot of big stuff opening.
Hobbit.
Start with The Hobbit, which I did not see, and I'm never going to.
Part 2 of The Hobbit, or part 5.
Of Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings / Hobbit.
The Desolation of Smaug.
And it really, in my mind, it really is part 5. It's part 2 of 6, but... we've already seen 4, 5, and 6.
Kinda so it's like Star Wars.
It's not like Star Wars, yeah. Bilbo has the ring. This is what I said in my review on movies.com. Who are the casual fans of this? You're either really, you're in the tank by now or you're not. Everyone has made their choice. I don't think there's anybody walking in to Hobbit Part 2 and saying, what's this all about?
I would say, if anything, you probably are a casual fan compared to most, just because you haven't read the books.
I've read the books.
You aren't steeped.
I'm never going to read the
books. You aren't steeped in sort of Tolkieniana. Because apparently, because The Hobbit is a fairly slim volume, they padded on the 3 movies.
Some Silmarillion.
Yeah, they're digging into Silmarillion and other stuff. So you're actually the casual fan, and you're just seeing the movies.
Well, but I really like the movies.
Yes.
I did not like Part 1. As we discussed when Part 1 came out.
The crispy fried, high frame rate Part 1.
Scouring, scraping my eyeballs out of my skull with a fork.
And you can see this one that way if you want.
Right. They're giving you, seriously, 6 different ways to see this movie. You can see it in real D with a low frame rate, the 24 frames per second rate.
Right.
You can see it in high frame rate in... Real D or IMAX 3D. You can see it in
flat.
You can see it 2D at the low frame rate, which is how, thankfully, I got to see it. Thanks to you. You got me into a screening that was 24 frames and
2D.
And 2D. And I had a really good time because I could finally just watch the movie. And
you didn't feel like you were bumping into the props.
I would have had a better time if the theater I was in had not been a theater. If instead it had just been a big recliner and I was, you know, covered by a nice blanket. Because for me, these movies, they're extremely long. They're laughably long. They're like three. This was like 230, 240. But Hobbit was, the first one was like three, almost three. And Bilbo has the ring. He's got to get everybody through. Run, run, run. Chase, chase, chase. Fight, fight, fight. Run, run, run. Chase, chase, chase. Fight, fight, fight.
To be continued.
To be continued. Yeah. This time around, the big thing is trying to get the gold from the mountain that the Smaug, dragon named Smaug, voiced by Benedict Cumberbatch. Mm-hmm.
Is it mocap by Benedict Cumberbatch as well?
If it is, then he flew.
I mean the face and stuff.
That dragon did not look like Benedict Cumberbatch to me. But, you know, maybe I wasn't paying enough attention to see if
it looked like Gollum. Gollum doesn't look like that guy.
He kind of does.
The gorilla looks more like him, I think, than Gollum.
Well, yeah, yeah, yeah.
What's it? Why am I forgetting his name?
Andy Serkis.
Andy Serkis, thank you.
God. So, they got to get the gold. The Smaug is sleeping in the mountain inside he's inside the gold. And so, like, they have to get the thing, what's it called? There's a thing that's in the gold that's a bright white thing. I'm forgetting the name. I feel like I'm an idiot.
Casual fan.
I'm a casual fan. I'm sorry. I forget the name of the thing that Bilbo has to get from Smaug inside the mountain. Anyway, they got to retrieve the gold. They got to get rid of Smaug so that the dwarves can reestablish the kingdom of Erebor.
Right.
Which is their thing.
Sure.
And the dwarves are led by, you know, super heart-throbby Thorin Oakenshield. Played by Richard Armitage, who's like the handsomest dwarf ever in the world. Like, he kind of steals the thunder from Martin Freeman. Like, he's so dashing.
Right.
That Martin Freeman is, you know, sort of hapless. He's like, oh, I'm just, you know, I'm just a little hobbit, you know.
Well,
like,
that's the character. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
And so you're sort of like,
you don't cast Martin Freeman when you're for you dashing. Feel, you cast him for bumbling.
Yeah. You feel for Bilbo. But you want to be led by Thorin Oakenshield. So it's a good time because it is that sort of comforting repetition. It's like being told the same bedtime story every night for 2 weeks. You're like, again, tell me that story again. And because there's nothing new happening. It's like run, 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 chase, 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 fight, fight, fight. And I really like watching that. When I'm in these movies, they can't be long enough. I just want to be. It's a very comforting experience for me. The effects are great. The action sequences are great. These films are basically about nothing. You know, I'm sure Tolkien had some moral point. Good versus evil, etc.
Right.
Something Christian-y, probably. But...
Really? Was Tolkien...
I'm... Maybe.
Are you sure you're not thinking of C.S. Lewis?
Well, I know that a lot of Christian-y people I knew back in the 70s and 80s, they were into Tolkien.
Maybe they were just nerds.
They might have been just born-again nerds. Anyway, yeah, it's. I wish I had more to say other than I really do like these movies.
It's satisfying.
Yeah, it's a fun adventure to watch.
It's fun to enjoy.
It's fun to enjoy. And I could watch, you know, the Lord of the Rings movies on the couch a lot, many times, again and again. I could do that. I never have time to do that, but, you know.
Just do it when I'm not home.
In the same way that I want to watch Gentlemen Prefer Blondes at least once a year,
I would
watch, you know, the Lord of the Rings
movies. No, I understand that level of comfort, sure. Yeah, let's. I kind of want to race through the new movies because we also need to talk about Love Actually.
Well, yeah. Well, why don't you race through those two that you saw that I didn't
sure,
see?
Yeah, okay.
I don't like,
yeah,
care.
Fine. All right. Yeah. First is Ours, which, going back to the late Paul Walker, is a film that stars Paul Walker that premiered at South by Southwest and is opening right now at. Shockingly soon after his tragic death in an accidental car
accident. That's a coincidence, right?
Yeah, total coincidence. Yeah. It was already set to go. And it's an interesting setup for a movie. He plays a guy who's bringing his wife into the hospital 5 weeks premature because she's about to give birth. She gives birth, the baby lives, the wife dies. The baby needs to be in a respirator for 48 hours before it sort of learns to breathe on its own, so it'll be okay. Oh, did I mention that Hurricane Katrina is happening outside? So the hospital gets evacuated. They tell him that there's like, you know, oh, there's a generator and there's batteries. You'll be fine. Power goes out. Turns out the battery in the respirator holds like 3 minutes of charge. Boom. So he has to keep manually cranking this battery and trying to keep it going, trying to like find food, trying to get help, trying to fend off the looters who show up to steal drugs. Having visions of his late wife, played by Genesis Rodriguez, an actress we like, who was in Man on a Ledge? No. Yes. Man on a Ledge.
Yeah.
Which Erin Quill was in. I did not know this. She told
I'm sorry,
me
to, what?
Our friend Erin Quill played a policewoman in Man on a Ledge.
Where was I?
I never knew this.
Did I miss her?
Apparently
on
we did.
What, was I looking the other way?
She apparently gets a check every time it
walked
goes on.
Across.
Anyway, so it really winds up kind of being this.
Did we actually talk about her appearance in the film when we reviewed it here on the show?
I don't think so.
The show's been on. We've been doing this long enough to have talked about Man on
We might Lash. Have, yeah. I don't remember her being in
Did
it.
Did we talk about it and then we just forgot that she was in it because she just wafted through one scene?
It's possible, but who knows? Anyway, it's kind of a one-man show almost because people sort of drift in and out of the movie, but it's mostly Paul Walker talking to his infant daughter, talking to a stray dog who shows up and hangs out with him, and having, you know, but he is on screen the entire time, often by himself. And he's quite good in it. I don't want to like get super hyperbolic because, you know, he's dead and it's a sad thing that he's dead. And here he's really branching out from the stuff that he's been doing before. But this is the kind of movie that you make when you are a movie star and you want to prove that you're an actor.
Right.
You know, it's a challenge. And for the most part, I'd say he meets that challenge. The movie itself doesn't have enough in it to go for a full 87 minutes or whatever of all this. I think I said in my review on therap.com that if it were a 50-minute episode of like an anthology TV show, that it would have been a classic. Because you've got this great sort of ticking clock thing. You've got this man alone as the elements are raging outside. It's not a gross Katrina movie in the way that we've had so many gross 9/11 movies. It's an interesting backdrop, and it acknowledges all the awful stuff that went down in New Orleans and the kind of breakdown of how things were. People were supposed to get rescued, and social services were supposed to help people.
Right.
So it's a flawed film, but it's an interesting one. And if you are upset about the death of Paul Walker and sort of want to pay tribute to the potential that he might have had as an actor if his career had continued, this would be a good place to start. I think. The other movie that I saw this week that you did not was Some Velvet Morning. Some Velvet Morning, which is written and directed by Neil LaBute, and stars Alice Eve and Stanley Tucci and nobody else.
Lee Hazelwood's son.
Is it?
Some Velvet Morning.
Interesting. Yeah. As Chrissy said, it's what we call in the business a two-hander. They're the only characters in the film. Alice Eve has a nice apartment in New York. Stanley Tucci shows up at her door one day with luggage and says, "I have left my wife of 24 years to be with you, my mistress." She's not so excited
she's
to hear
like,
about
whatever,
it.
Man.
Yeah, she's not so excited to hear about
washing
it.
Washing my hair.
They actually met when she was dating his son, and she sort of slipped a note in
That's
his pocket.
Right.
They start having an affair. It's very Neil LaBute. If you saw In the Company of Men, if you saw Your Friends and Neighbors, it's very that sort of men versus women kind of thing. Some people have accused him in the past of being misogynist. I think in this case, the combatants are more evenly matched. And they, you know, every time you think that one person is the victim and the other one's a monster, there will be some new revelation that they make either something that we don't know or something that they don't know about each other that gets revealed, where you think, oh, okay, then maybe not. And so you're constantly sort of shifting gears as to who you're you know, on the side of. The two performances are really good. You know, Tucci really kind of tears into it, and, you know, it's fun to see. He's been playing a lot of sort of innocuous characters in, you know, Devil Wears Prada and Burlesque and stuff of late, so it's kind of fun to see him really just be a capital B bastard. And I've always really liked Alice Eve ever since we saw She's Out of Your League. I thought she was an interesting actress, and she is more often than not kind of window dressing, but I think here she gets good stuff to do, and she totally matches Tucci, and it's really intense. It's not fully successful, and it feels reminiscent of a lot of sort of one man, one woman yelling at each other for 90 minutes plays and movies that you've seen before.
Right.
But if you like that sort of thing, it's done well here, and, you know, I'd rather LeBute do this than to do another, you know, whatever, Lakeview Terrace, whatever that crazy movie was called.
What?
Remember where Patrick Wilson and Kerry Washington move in next door to Sam Jackson?
Yeah. Was that Neil LaBute?
Yeah.
That was a cool movie.
No, it wasn't. It was stupid.
That's what I mean.
Yes. And then and let's not forget his Wicker Man remake. Yeah. So this, at least, I think he's more on home turf. So, you know.
I like Lakeview Terrace.
Gosh. Sun Velvet Morning, it's not great, but it's pretty good. Worth checking out if you're a fan of any of those folks. Saving Mr. Banks.
What about Madea?
All right, Madea Christmas.
Tyler Perry's A Madea Christmas.
Tyler Perry's A Madea Christmas. So after the disappointing Tyler Perry's Madea's Witness Protection.
Do we want to just say it was disappointing? It was more than disappointing. It was
soul-crushing.
God-awful and soul-crushing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where he clearly could barely be bothered to show up, direct, be Madea. Like, it even felt like he was barely even wearing the makeup. Like, it was all so thrown together and haphazard and lazy and not funny. And, again, we have liked Madea movies in the past. Madea's Big Happy Family, super hilarious. And has a lot of really great set pieces in it and fun stuff. So after Witness Protection, it was a little like, oh, what's this, you know,
what's it going to do next?
What's Madea Christmas going to be? And Madea Christmas, when Madea is on screen.
When it's Madea, it's.
Is a lot of fun.
It's really, really funny.
I mean, you don't even care about the plot, but it basically involves her.
And neither does Tyler Perry.
Neither does Tyler Perry, yeah. Madea goes to Alabama with a friend to visit her daughter. She doesn't know that her daughter is married to a white guy, and the white guy's parents show up, and they're Kathy Najimy and Larry the Cable Guy. And there's like a dam.
Man Madea. Larry the Cable Guy.
Man Madea. There's a dam upriver that's killing the farms, and the school doesn't have any money, and they've got to take the Jesus out of the Christmas pageant.
The white husband has a new strain of drought-resistant corn
that he will not stop talking about. And Chad Michael Murray is a mean redneck, but then his car turns over and he gets rescued by a black lady.
Yeah.
And
Sweet Brown and Antoine Dotson are in
show
it.
Up. Yeah, there's all kind of things happening.
It is a bad film, but it's a different kind of bad film than Witness Protection. And it's because you feel a kind of weird, crazy energy in this one.
In the Madea sequences.
In the Madea sequences that you did not feel during the Madea sequences of Madea's Witness Protection.
Yeah, he seems to be feeling it, or at least faking it again.
It feels like there is no script going on in this film other than when, you know, B-Unit is taking care of business with all the plot.
Right.
That means nothing.
But even the plot.
Tyler Perry doesn't care.
No.
About the plot.
Here's an example.
He lets things hang in the air. He lets things just drop. He never addresses stuff that he brings up.
Yeah. Here's an example. Just one of the many threads of the tapestry that is A Madea Christmas. Okay. So the school needs money to put on the big Christmas Jubilee, which the town relies on because it's a tourist attraction and they sell poinsettias and all this stuff happens. They get sponsorship money from this company that A, turns out they built the dam that's ruining the town, and B, in the fine print of the contract that nobody bothered to read, they have to remove all references to Christ and the Nativity and Jesus and everything.
Like, nobody bothered to read the
nobody
contract.
Nobody reads the contract because they were just excited to get the money. Okay, so then you get to the end of the movie and you think, all right, well, what's going to be the great plan? They're going to sneak Jesus back into the pageant because it's very much like, aha, I've figured out a way around this.
No.
It just happens.
Right.
You get there, the big banner behind the stage says, Merry Christmas. And then they just immediately start being Christmassy and singing Jesus-y songs. And like, there's not even a moment of like someone trying to pull the plug or the company right. guy saying, you promise. Nothing. It's just, it's gone. It is out of the movie like it never happened.
So we're talking about the boring stuff. Let's stop talking about the boring
so
stuff.
Yes, so that's, all that stuff is awful.
This is the stuff that makes the movie a bad film.
However.
What makes the movie a good film?
Madea. Okay, she's in a Mrs. Claus outfit being awful to rude customers in a department store. And then she is...
Calling a lady, Hunty.
Hunty. Then she stumbles into a Klan meeting.
Go Google that.
Which, unfortunately, you'd wish they might build to something it doesn't, but it's still this crazy physical moment of her diving back into the back right. of an SUV.
Right.
She substitute teaches a class.
She crucifies a child.
Yeah. This movie has an anti-bullying message.
Misbehaving child.
The solution to bullying is either mock crucify a bratty little girl with Christmas lights or punch a guy in the face.
Yeah.
And then, what else? Oh, and then she banters with Larry the Cable Guy and Kathy Najimy.
And they seem to be having a really good time.
That's kind of the highlights of the film.
I don't want to get into the should Madea exist argument.
Too late.
Because
she exists.
That ship has sailed.
Yeah.
Like, you can protest the existence of Madea all you want. It doesn't make her less funny.
Right.
Madea is the one thing that Tyler Perry does right.
Yeah.
He goes out of his way to make these films that he presents as sort of important dramatic stories, moral dramas.
Yeah, not just for colored girls, which was clearly his attempt to be like...
Temptation, Confessions of a Marriage Counselor, was meant to be a serious film.
Yeah.
A very serious
good deeds.
Film. Good deeds, which actually wasn't horrible.
Well, it was competently put together, right. but it was still pretty stiff.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is that the one thing he really knows how to do, because he's not good at anything else,
is Madea. How great would it be to have Madea in a movie directed by somebody else, like somebody right. who actually understood how to make a comedy.
Yeah.
And let Tyler Perry write the Madea stuff, the things that let him improv however Madea happens.
It's all improv. It's just he's making it up as he goes along. You can feel it, especially when he's talking to Larry the Cable.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And if you look at the outtakes and the closing credits, I mean, yeah, there's no script.
There's a bare bone outline of something, and they're just flying around.
In this scene, we're going to... This information will be divulged, but beyond that, right. it's... Yeah. But, yeah, if you could just let him be Madea in the context of a movie that was made by somebody who knew what they were doing, that would be the best. Second best would be make, as I said in my review on the wrap, make Medea's duck soup. Like, take out all the stupid melodrama and the plotting that makes no sense, that even Tyler Perry doesn't care about. And just a pure nothing but... two barrels of Madea comedy.
Right.
That would be terrific.
I laugh so much when she's just relentlessly cruel to people.
Yeah. Her malapropisms.
The malapropisms make me laugh. Her allusions to the things that Tyler Perry... Okay. Tyler Perry has come out and said he will no longer have Madea... carrying a gun
or smoking weed,
and yet she still to this day in this film talks about having a gun in her purse and smoking weed
and having worked the pole
and having been a stripper. So it's like Tyler Perry doesn't even listen to himself. Like it is as though Madea is this demonic thing that takes over him. Like the Tasmanian devil, you know.
He just goes with it.
And when he's not being Madea, he's like, oh, no, I would never advocate drug use or violence. And then Madea comes along, he's like, yeah, smoke weed, shoot people in the face with a gun. Like, and I cannot stop laughing. I understand that this is as low as lowbrow gets.
Right.
And I'm in love with her. Like, it's... I want there to be, like you just said, I want there to be a pure Madea film that's just anarchy and chaos.
Yeah.
Because I know it's inside him. And I know that what he needs is to give himself permission. ambition.
Right. No, I think...
to be that person.
I think he's afraid of losing
the audience. He's a very conflicted filmmaker.
Very much so.
In many ways. Not a very talented one either, but more importantly than his lack of talent or having talent is you could feel the conflict inside of him.
Yeah.
It's all over all of his movies.
Yeah.
He has...
the weird sexual judgment.
Life events that the world does not know about that are somehow they're getting into the movies anyway.
There's a doctoral thesis in this.
At what point do you dig into a reference to RuPaul's Drag Race?
Right.
And drag culture. Mm-hmm. Not just the fact that you've got a man wearing a dress.
Right.
But a reference on screen in spoken dialogue to drag culture.
Right. Martin Lawrence is never going to do that
using
in Big Mama's
slang
house.
That is only used by, like, career drag queens.
Right.
You know. What does that mean? You know, he's never going to tell us what that means. Or he may when he's old. But yeah. You know, but it's a weird, weird thing. And I remember last time there was a movie, Jen Yamato, our friend, interviewed him for one of the, whatever film it was. And she brought up point after point after point, like stuff she saw in the film. And every answer he gave her was, oh, I never thought about that. No, I never thought about that. So either he really is clueless about what he's giving the world. Or he is the biggest liar in the world.
He is exceedingly cagey.
Yeah. So I find him fascinating, and I find Madea hilarious. This extraneous plot stuff about saving the town and the drought-resistant corn and the Christmas pageant and stuff. I don't care about any of it. I'll tell you another thing I liked. I am not a fan of his, you know, technical skills as a filmmaker. But at least this time around, we are provided with a series of wipes that are really so terrific.
Like a spinning tree that like wipes from one edge of the screen to the other with little twinkle dust.
Yeah,
you know?
Like and jingle bells ringing.
Yeah,
and,
or like a rolling wreath
like,
or something.
Yeah, like you said, not since Xanadu have we been treated to such extravagantly weird screen wipes to go from one scene to another.
So go see this movie right now.
Yeah, totally.
Is what we're saying.
Go see it before Christmas, because after Christmas it won't matter. Yeah. And wait, next year it's going to be on OWN a lot.
Probably, yeah.
You can watch it then. You can wait a year.
Yeah, because you know,
the man needs the money.
If you open a Christmas movie on December 13th, you're basically saying like 2 weekends and we're out.
Right. All right. So, what's the
Saving Mr. Banks,
which opens limited?
Yes.
Right now.
Uh huh. And then it will expand later.
So most of y'all can't even see Saving Mr. Banks right now.
Right.
But it opened in New York and Los Angeles and some other big cities.
Yeah.
So
it's basically a completely not true version of author P.L. Travers, played by Emma Thompson, coming to Burbank, where Walt Disney, played by Tom Hanks, is trying to convince her to sell him the rights to Mary Poppins. She has very strict ideas about what she will and will not allow in a movie version and does not want it to become another Disney cartoon. And so she is very tough and throws up a lot of roadblocks to the Sherman brothers who are writing songs and to the screenwriter. And Walt eventually sort of coaxes her to...
coaxes and cajoles and pets and
points out what they have in common
and therapizes her.
A good chunk of the film is devoted to Travers' flashbacks to growing up in Australia with a very charming and twinkly and drunk dad played by Colin Farrell.
Perfect casting.
He's great. And I think that when the similarly twinkly but sober Walt Disney tries to woo her, she's kind of not having it this time.
Uh-huh.
I saw this movie a couple months ago and was thoroughly charmed by it and thought it was lovely. And I now I'm reading a lot of reviews.
And then you found out the truth.
A lot of reviews that are saying that this is bunk.
None of it happened. None of it happened.
That Travers did not like Disney, did not like the movie, like not kept at it, all. Had it in her will that no American would ever again touch Mary Poppins.
Apparently he had no involvement with her.
Yeah, he hid out in Palm Springs to not have to deal with her. She was bisexual. I mean, like all these interesting things about her.
Had
an adopted child that she had separated from his twin.
Identical twin.
And so I've read these really scathing reviews.
She was a treat in real life.
I've read scathing reviews that take it to task on that, and I read them and I don't disagree with anything they say, and yes, they're absolutely right. This is reprehensible, and how can they do this, and blah, blah, blah. But you know what? I still was charmed by the movie.
Well,
if you can forget that these people actually existed and that what's being presented is a thoroughly false version of actual events, it's a delightful sort of examination of art and artists and why people tell stories and what personal demons they exercise through them.
If you go back and you read Mary Poppins, the book, the first Mary Poppins book, there were a series of Mary Poppins books, but you go back and read the first Mary Poppins book, which I recently did.
She's a tough customer.
She's very stern. She is a stern governess. She brooks no problems with these children. And, you know, obviously she's in touch with magical stuff, but she's not, you know, she and Julie Andrews, she ain't singing at these kids. She's not, like, you know, charming them.
Right.
And then you look at the film that became, you know, one of Disney's most beloved, you know. And really one of the best Disney films.
Oh yeah, coincidentally turning 50 this year.
Yeah.
So in a way, Saving Mr. Banks is this sort of corporate product designed to promote the 50th anniversary DVD.
There is that. That's part of this. So you look at the book, and then you look at the film, and you realize that this is someone else's idea of what they wish Mary Poppins had been. This is an interpretation of Mary Poppins. It doesn't have much to do with the book. It's the version that Walt Disney wished for his daughters, apparently. You know, and so you've got singing, and you've got dancing, and you've got animation, and you've got, you know, a million
Dick Van Dyke
other things. Yeah, Dick Van Dyke doing the worst, like the worst British accent. Yeah, like someone last week tweeted to me and said, "You know, Dave, I think you're awesome, but I really cringe when you try to speak French." Because I was trying to say the name of Process de Jean d'Arc.
Procès de Jean d'Arc.
Process de Jean d'Arc. Okay. And I said, "I'm just trying to say the title of the movie." And he's like, "Oh, I've been too hard on you." And I'm like, "No, you're not too hard on me at all. Scold me for being terrible. I am terrible at saying things in French. I don't speak French. And so, and I can't pronounce French things when I see them." So, you know, he's the worst British accent in film history, probably, after, like, maybe Robin Hood and Kevin Costner.
But that was a non-accent.
Right. And so, you know, what you have is this movie, which takes a thing that is somewhat related to P.L. Travers, And makes its own story out of
They've Mary Poppins-ized Mary Poppins.
They have Mary Poppins-ized the story of Mary Poppins' trip from book to film.
Interesting.
They have created a legend where none existed. They have written the story the way Disney wishes the story had ended, with P.L. Travers loving it and crying cathartic tears of, you know, release and
at the Chinese theater.
At Grauman's Chinese. And that's not what happened.
No.
Nope. None of it. Nothing happened like this. Having said that,
Hollywood history is littered with biopics and historical films that are completely made up.
A pack of falsehoods. And yet I found this movie, just like you, kind of charming and very sweet. And if I didn't know the reality of what happened, I would believe it wholeheartedly and be happy. when I walked out. They even, like, isn't it great? Isn't Walt Disney great? Isn't the Disney Corporation great to do this wonderful thing? Not only did they make Mary Poppins, but they helped P.L. Travers understand herself.
Her own past.
Yeah.
And they even stack the deck by, over the closing credits, air a rolling audio tape of one of her actual sessions with the Sherman Brothers.
Yes.
Where she's being all tough and she's demanding. Browbeating. You know, yeah.
It's great.
So you think, ah, oh, well, clearly then, this they obviously had the tapes. This right. is this must be all factual, you know.
Wrong.
But it is as to quote another to quote another Sherman Brothers song, it is satisfactual. And then there is American Hustle, also opening in limited release this weekend and expanding later.
Like
six screens this weekend. Screens, yeah, so quite likely not near you. My second favorite film of the year.
It's really terrific.
It's dynamite. I'll tell you my first favorite later in this year.
Talk about this movie.
Okay, so it's David O. Russell, and it is sort of, kind of, about the Abscam entrapment scandal of the late 70s, whereby various members of Congress and other politicians were set up to take bribes from fake Arab sheiks and, I think, Korean businessmen. This movie kind of tells it as... more from the partly from the con artist's point of view and partly from the Fed's point of view. And it is a movie about, you know, it's one of those who's fooling who and who's going to wind up on top kind of films. But it's also a love story, and it's also a character piece, and it's also a very dark comedy, all set against sort of very stylish late 70s. This is not kind of the garish, ha-ha late 70s.
Well, the men are. The men are very sort of grotesque,
I guess, in their appearance. But there's still, you know,
Women look astounding.
The women look great. Yeah. The wallpaper looks great. Yeah. Studio 54 looks fun. It's just, it's got a real driving energy, the way that Goodfellas does, this real sort of snap to it, and you just, you know, at one point you've got four competing narrators, and you're thinking, there's no way he's going to pull this off, and he pulls it off.
Yeah,
it is exciting and fun and funny and exhilarating. I love this movie.
I like how if someone asks you what it's about, you go, it's about Abscam. And you're like, well, what's that? You're like, who even remembers Abscam?
I remember it thanks to Doonesbury.
I remember it only because I was a child who watched the news. And they would talk about it, and I would think to myself, I'm going to go get a donut because I don't understand. And when I say I'm going to go get a donut at age 11 in my own home, I mean that my dad used to buy Morton's frozen jelly donuts. You used to be able to buy frozen donuts.
I thought you meant like a donut or something.
No, I mean donuts.
Okay.
Morton's, do you remember Morton's, the brand?
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
They don't exist anymore. But they used to make frozen jelly donuts. And they'd come six in a package, and you would buy them, and you would just put them in your fridge, and they would thaw out, and then you could either eat them cold like that, or you could put them on your, you know, on the counter and thaw them out to room temperature, and you would have a donut. A frozen donut. I remember them being really delicious. I'm sure they were awful.
I bet they were.
I'm sure they were the worst things in the world. But when you're, you know, nine, you think, wow, frozen donuts. Like, you really
so want. Convenient.
Yeah, and so... but I remember that those kind of things on the news when I was that age would make me zone out because I couldn't understand what was happening. And because of that, I, you know, just forgot about it. I think a lot of people forgot about it. And that's not even really the point of the film. The point of the movie, I think, is much like The Fighter and much like, you know, his other sort of, you know, grounded in regular humans sort of stories. People taking what little scraps of opportunity that life has given them.
Three Kings.
And inventing stuff for themselves.
Right.
Inventing careers, inventing identities, inventing, you know, crime opportunities.
Reimagining themselves.
Yeah.
Even like I Heart Huckabees is about people sort of chasing, like trying to present this image to the world and create this image of themselves
and
to
so,
give to people.
And because of that, I really appreciate David O. Russell's, you know, he pays such close attention to the details and rhythms of human weirdness and the lies people tell themselves to make themselves believe in the story that they're concocting for their own identity, their own path. Like, he is on board with their delusion and wants them to have the things they want. I really love his treatment of especially Jennifer Lawrence in this movie because she's stuck. She's stuck in a marriage to a guy who's cheating on her, and she's stuck in the suburbs where she doesn't really want to be. And she's stuck in a house because she has anxiety. She's somewhat agoraphobic and doesn't want to go outside. But she's constantly reading about stuff and trying to, like, find her way through. And every time she's on screen, first of all, she steals every scene she's in.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Every time she's on screen, she's talking to Christian Bale about some new idea that she has. And the look on Christian Bale's face every time she talks is, I can't handle her anymore.
Christian Bale,
and she never stops talking.
Yeah.
So, like, and she won't allow him a word in until she's done saying the things that she's going to say. And it always comes back to, and this is the best line in the movie, she says, "So, thank God for me."
Christian Bale, who is
laughing.
Who's hysterical in this, calls her the Picasso of passive-aggressive karate. And, like, there's a scene where later in the film, she blurts out something that could conceivably have everyone killed, basically. Right. But Christian Bale finds out about this, and she launches into this explanation as to why she said it and why it was a good thing.
And you believe her by the time
by the end
done.
Of it, he thanks her for it.
Thank you for your plan.
Oh, my God.
It was my plan.
Christian Bale is amazing in this. He's so funny. I don't think he's been funny at all since American Psycho.
No.
He's hysterical in this. Yeah. Amy Adams, super sexy and, like, you know, like,
and dark and complicated.
Yeah,
and,
like, one of those people that you can just tell her mind is constantly,
like,
sort
constantly
of racing and
grifting all the time.
She's working the long con. Bradley Cooper plays this FBI agent who may be the least moral of all of them. Jeremy Renner is this mayor who gets sucked up into the scandal, but he might actually kind of be a nice guy and is just sort of in over his head.
Right.
He's really loose and funny, which is he's never.
I loved this.
It's really. So great.
And I especially love, going back to Jennifer Lawrence, I especially love the opportunity that we have. I remember I've in my spare time, I spend a lot of a spare time. I should say this differently. When I'm on YouTube, I don't spend a lot of time on YouTube. I'm not scouring the internet all day. But when I'm on YouTube, I invariably go to some old Aretha Franklin performance from the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And because to watch her in her 20s is this overwhelming experience. And there's a clip that I saw of Aretha Franklin on Soul Train, which is on a clip you can see on YouTube, where Don Cornelius introduces her and says, and this is how he introduces her on an episode of Soul Train, "I am lucky to be alive while this woman is singing and making music." And so are you. And I feel, we've had Jennifer Lawrence in films now for a few years. But I am very excited about her as a screen presence. Like, I don't get overly excited about actresses or actors or anybody. Like, I respect their work if they're good at what they do. But every once in a while, someone comes along who feels like they are on fire, not to make a Hunger Games pun here, but who really feels like they are just unfolding in front of you and, like, becoming something wild in front of you. And that's how I feel about her. Now, it's not just the fact that she has an off-screen persona that is so rad, where every time she opens her mouth, she's saying something funny and smart and self-deprecating and weird and anti-celebrity-ish in a way that makes you think, like, celebrities, they're just like us, you know, like, because that level of wit is not just like us. She's young and witty and smart and clever and with it. And unless someone has got an earpiece, unless she's wearing an earpiece and Albert Brooks from Broadcast News is delivering lines into her head to say everywhere she goes, she's very smart and very cool. So not even taking into account that off-screen persona, on-screen, she's really exciting to watch and womanish at a very young age, which is also exciting because it's hard to watch some of these actresses who have either affected or who simply are very sort of frail and girlish and not in command of themselves. They don't have that quality of self-possession that she really has.
We've had a long waify period.
Yeah.
You know, the Winona Ryders and the Gwyneth Paltrows and the girly women. And I think she's a womany girl, you know, who's becoming a womany woman.
Yeah.
You know, she is, I pointed out recently.
I am lucky to be alive while she is beginning her career. I get to watch her
it is exciting.
Do her thing.
It is an
exciting. Unless she burns out in some weird, spectacular way, which I hope she doesn't.
No, no. Her trajectory is amazing. I mean, it's like I was saying recently, you know, Kathleen Turner was 26 when she was in Body Heat.
Right.
Think of a 26-year-old since then who's had those kind of, not just the curves, but sort of on-screen presence, that maturity, that
womanliness. I'm not even talking about the body.
No. Either. I'm just saying that presence of knowledge and experience and things going on behind the eyes, you know. And that's what Jennifer Lawrence has.
Yeah. Super into her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Love Actually. Turns 10, and the internet is losing its crap over it. There have been...
Also, we went to see it.
There were debates. There are articles. Like, everybody is like, I love Love Actually. I hate Love Actually. It's become this crazy thing. And we went and saw it this week on the big screen.
We went to the Arclight Sherman Oaks, and we watched it with a big crowd of people.
Yes.
Some of them obsessive, who knew that the word actually is spoken in the film 22 times.
Right.
That kind of fan of Love Actually. Now, we are different sorts of fans.
We're Christmas and Easter Jews, if you will.
Indeed. And I know, having seen it now several times, it's not. It's not a good movie.
No. I even say in...
It's not...
In Have Yourself a Little Christmas that it's indefensible but it's kind of adorable anyway.
There's a lot to like about it, but it's not a good film. There's so many problems.
It's problematic.
but I do watch it at Christmas time because it's so nice and sweet. And well, when Emma Thompson cries, I cry.
Yeah,
like you know, I would watch that entire movie that was all about her.
It's one of the sort of we've talked before on the show, like with the Tesco ads and whatnot. Like the British really have made this sort of beautiful bauble of the secular Christmas, and all of that sort of shiny comes through in this movie really well. And watching it again,
they do Christmas the right way.
Oh yeah,
because they don't fight about the religious aspect about it like we do here. Like the religious conservative people of the United States have a bug up their butt about secularizing Christmas.
Right.
And they will not shut up. And they make everyone annoyed, frankly, constantly, all the time.
Like, I feel guilty now saying Merry Christmas because now it's like, oh, well, does it sound like I'm capitulating to Fox News, you know?
Right.
Just let it go.
They are bound and determined to make Christmas unpleasant.
Right.
In this weird, ironic way. Like, they want it to be...
They'll destroy it to save it.
They want it to be their property, and then what they're doing is wrecking everybody's good time.
What they want is it to be the only thing.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, the Hanukkah doesn't count or whatever, you know, like, nothing else. You can't say Happy Holidays. It has to be Merry Christmas because anything else than that is subversive.
Even though holiday comes from Holy Day.
Exactly.
So it's
that's like what the people that made a big deal about Xmas, and that's a religious thing, too.
It's an anti-intellectual sort of situation. Like, you have to not be smart to follow their reasoning.
Right.
To go through with it. But in the UK, they don't give a damn about that stuff. It is an entirely secular holiday that pays attention to the religious element of it,
And those who celebrate it
get hung up on it. It's right. a party.
Yeah.
And so what you have over there, people don't, from what I've observed, people don't run around saying happy holidays over there. They say happy Christmas or Merry Christmas, depending on, you know, how Americanized their own, you know, language, their own usage has become. And it's just a big fun time.
And it's a blurry line anyway. I mean, if you watch The Real Story of Christmas, which is airing a couple times on History Channel this month, which I'm on, they talk about how it was a holiday that was all about wild drunken revelry, and that's why like Oliver Cromwell actually banned it for a while, and how really that the Christians basically sort of glommed their own stuff onto the Yuletide and onto, you know, Saturnalia and the solstice and all that stuff, and how Jesus was probably born in March, and you know, all this. So trying to get all huffy about Christmas now, it's a little late. It's always been kind of this blur of the secular and the spiritual anyway.
So anyway, Love Actually. I took notes.
I was noticing that.
During the screening. I feel there are burning unresolved questions.
Okay.
How do you hide multiple trombones
at a wedding?
In a church pew at a wedding. That's question.
That's one. Okay.
I'm giving these questions to the universe right now. I'm listeners, if you have any answers and you would like to answer my questions, you should tell me your thoughts.
Where can they contact you, Dave?
We have an email account. It's linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
Correct.
linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
It only took you 3 years to learn it.
Well, I had it down a couple weeks ago, and then I sort of
forgot again.
Felt proud of myself for a little bit, and then forgot about it again.
Feeling pretty proud of yourself.
When you are at work, does your boss call you into the office and ask you personal love questions? And do you allow him to do this? And
HR might be totally different in the UK.
I don't know. Yeah, what is HR like in the United Kingdom? Is it okay for Snape to call you into the office and say, who are you in love with? Why don't you go do something about it? I don't get it. Okay. Why isn't the world full of chocolate biscuits? Why do only British people get chocolate biscuits and other Europeans? Why can't we have more chocolate biscuits in the United States? I'm perfectly willing to eat as many as you can bring to grocery stores in our country. But we live in a bereft society.
True. I mean, we're lucky, relatively. We
live in Los Angeles.
We have shops in the neighborhood.
We live in Los Angeles. That's why we're lucky.
Yeah, they carry chocolate and hobnobs.
We get this stuff because we live in a giant city.
Yes.
But if we lived in, you know, some other town.
Bug Tussle, Alabama, which is the actual town where the Medea Christmas thing is set.
We would have to get these things from the internet.
Yes.
And wait a long time.
And pay a lot of shipping.
And pay a lot of shipping costs.
Okay.
So why are there not more chocolate biscuits everywhere?
Go on.
Why is Snape's secretary such a slag and a whore?
Because she's working for evil.
Who suggests, what father suggests that he and his son watch Titanic together?
Stepson.
Who thinks that's a good idea? Why is that the cure for a broken heart or a sad time? Like, when you... There's a moment in the movie where Liam Neeson is like, oh, you're having a bad day, son? Let's watch Titanic. Why does that happen? Who thinks that's good?
Maybe they watch it like The Sound of Music, you know, when some parents cut it off right after So Long Farewell so the Nazis don't come in. Maybe.
So does Liam Neeson cut off Titanic
after he paints her in the car?
After he has sex with her in the steamy car?
Maybe.
Like, there you go, kid. That's love.
The end.
Find her. Get her naked. Paint her picture, bang her in the
steam
car.
Steam up the windows.
That's right. That boat went all the way to New York, and they lived happily ever after. Why is art on display in movies always so bad and ugly and fake?
Because it's easier to make fake bad art for a movie than to pay a real artist the rights to use their stuff, I guess. Unless you're Brett Ratner making Tower Heist.
Are all foreign policy meetings based on the rivalry between two men for Martine McCutcheon?
Yes.
She's a lovely woman.
She is. She's battled bankruptcy.
Chronic fatigue syndrome.
Yes. She,
I just read about this.
She's been through a lot, that Martine.
Is every foreign policy decision in the world based on, like, two guys wanting the same woman?
Well, I think most foreign policy decisions are probably based on measuring contests.
Well, yeah, I know.
Unless Angela Merkel is involved, but who knows.
What kind of insufferable a-hole writes a novel on a typewriter by a lake in December? Wearing the most, like, toolish J. Crew sweater in the world. That's my next question.
Okay.
Why do pretty girls want to make themselves ugly by wearing big blue velvet floppy hats?
I think that's one of those articles of clothing that's like, I'm so gorgeous, I can wear this, mm-hmm. and you still want to shag me.
Why must Dido? That's the question.
Yes, I know.
Why must Dido?
Go on.
I can't read my handwriting on this one. Why can't Laura Linney have a moment to herself?
I know.
What mental hospital allows you to use the phone all the time? What mental hospital allows you to use the phone all the time and doesn't just give you Thorazine to calm mm-hmm. you down and keep you in your place?
So that your sister can have sex with Rodrigo Santoro.
Your sister can have sex with Rodrigo Santoro. Finally, in a world where Claudia Schiffer exists, how do you explain the presence of Claudia Schiffer identical twin showing up named Carol?
She's a Christmas Carol? I don't know. Any listeners who have suggestions, please write us.
Those are my questions.
Here's what I figured out about Love Actually, watching it on its 10th anniversary, is that there has been a phenomenon of late in the last several years in music,
yeah.
where people will sample like the hook of a song, the juicy part of the song, the part of the song that you wait for the song to get to. And then they just repeat it over and over and over.
It doesn't
and over
happen again. So much anymore. It happened about 10 years ago.
Okay, yeah.
And it was a big, like, there was a miniature.
There was a moment of that.
Trend, yeah.
You know, that's what Love Actually is. It's basically if you sat through 16 rom-coms that were about those stories that are all unfolding in the film, and then somebody went through and made a mega mix of just all the best parts. And all the up moments, the stuff that you were most excited about, and then shoved them all into one movie, you would have Love Actually.
Oh, now this is the music part and not the singing part.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're not. This isn't what we're talking
Hang
about.
Hang on, wait a second. Let me get to this. There we go. Yeah. That.
Yeah. Love Actually is that.
That song, all that song is call on me,
call on me, call on me, call me for like 5 minutes.
Right.
Love Actually is 2+ hours of call on me.
Yeah. That's a good theory.
Yeah.
I think it's true.
I think it is.
Yeah. I like that call on me song.
I know you do.
It just. The guy keeps singing "Call on Me, Call on Me." Steve Winwood keeps singing "Call on Me,"
and with no verses to get in the way. As a reminder to everybody, we are still taking orders for autographed copies of "Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas." But
you ain't getting it for Christmas.
You're not getting it in time for Christmas at this point. If you've already ordered, then yes, you will be.
You
getting
will,
them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But as of now, it's too
the
late.
The T-shirts came in. We're sending those.
We
out.
Have the T-shirts. If you already ordered those, you'll be getting those in time for Christmas. If you mentioned that you wanted them in time for Christmas,
and I'll be contacting people. Like well, it's Sunday now. I'll be contacting people tomorrow and
finding out how pressing this is.
How badly do you need it before Christmas?
Right.
If you're listening right now and you know you badly need it before Christmas and you want to send us a special note and say, give it to me before Christmas, we'll make sure it gets there.
So the t-shirts are here. So yeah, drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We'll get that sorted out. And we want to especially thank, also available, our DVD commentary for White Christmas.
Yeah, don't forget that.
Because a steal at $1.99.
It's been very nice to watch people email us and give us $2 a pop for the White Christmas
and people on Facebook
episode, the special episode of White Christmas.
James and other folks on Facebook have said very nice things about the commentary, which we appreciate. And we wanted to thank Brian and David, who paid extra for no good reason for their White Christmas.
Threw money at us.
They was the tip jar.
Our big tip jar.
It was very sweet.
Very happy.
Really appreciate it. It was a nice holiday gesture.
Christmas.
So drop us a line, linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
Let's explain.
You can order the t-shirt, the commentary, the book, whatever.
Let's explain the commentary a little bit.
Sure.
Because we're assuming that people know what it is.
This is a new thing that we're starting on the show. People had asked us to do it, and we thought it was a fun idea. And, you know, the show is free, will always be free, and we're happy to provide it for free. But we thought we would maybe start doing some special stuff that we would ask you to pay a little extra for. And so
we'll pay anything for it.
Pay anything for it. Well, extra as in more than zero. So we decided that we would do DVD commentaries, and they would be we would actually do a little legwork and do some research and find out
just
about the movies.
A very little legwork.
Very little, granted. But we're not being riff tracksy. We're not being Mystery Science Theater about it. We're actually talking about the movie.
This is
sharing our insights about the film, and
this is an extra. What it is a special episode of the podcast.
Sure.
Where we take the film, start the movie, and talk until the movie's over.
Yes.
And we
talk about our own opinions. Talk about facts that we know about the film.
You can listen to it as you're watching the film with the sound down, or you can just listen to it as
the
a podcast.
The way you listen to the show. Yeah.
The way you listen to us in the first place. But it's, you know, it is devoted to one subject. It is devoted to that film.
Right.
So when you say it's a commentary, I sort of resist that word just a little bit. I mean, I'm going to use it for the sake of ease. But when I see a DVD commentary and I hear a DVD commentary when I'm watching something on an extra, I know that what we have done is not exactly that.
Well,
we're doing this podcast essentially.
Yes, and it's true. You know, but DVD commentaries are frequently by people who are involved in the making of the film,
right.
The director, the cast, the writers. But a lot of times you will have commentaries by scholars or just admirers of the film.
We are super scholarly.
So scholarly.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, even though we weren't involved with the film directly, we are bringing something to the table. We are, you know,
we have actually done our homework.
Yes, we found out. We've looked into the movie.
Month's,
we're providing our sort of critical analysis, and so we did White Christmas for our starter because it's a movie we've both seen 10,000
times.
January
there'll be a new film that we're going to do. We haven't decided yet exactly what it is.
We'll be
spending our Christmas break.
Yes.
Probably working on it.
And we've had actually some people that have wanted to vote, maybe asked us to give them choices.
Maybe you'll get to vote. I don't know. I haven't decided yet if I really care what you guys want.
So that. But yeah. So to check it out, if you would like to order it, drop us a line.
I mean, start throw suggestions our way.
Sure, yeah. On our
if
Twitter
catches,
page or Facebook
if
page.
If it catches my fancy, maybe.
I know people want us to do a Tyler Perry joint of some kind.
All right, we'll maybe eventually do one of those, but I want to do something good as well. You know, I don't want us to be like classic weird old corny movie like White Christmas, and then something terrible, and then another something terrible. Right. Like I know you had the idea that we were going to do Can't Stop the Music, which I'm totally into. I'm on board for that idea as either the next one or one that's coming up, but. This is not going to just be us ragging on movies. Like you just said, this is not Mystery Science Theater 3000 or Riff Tracks or Cinematic Titanic. That is someone else's job. Our job is not to do that.
Right.
Our job is to be film critics. And so, you know, I'm going to make you sit down and watch Ohasar Baltasar. That's what's going to happen. We're going to do one of those one of these days.
Fine.
It might not be the next one, but that's coming.
Fine. You know what? Then this will be all about the movies we've been trying to get each other to watch forever.
or occasionally.
Yeah.
We'll
so we can do Real Genius then, so you can finally watch that. So there.
In any case, that's what this is. We charge $1.99. How do they get White Christmas if they want to listen to the White Christmas commentary podcast?
Email us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We'll tell you where to PayPal us. If you don't like PayPal, we can work out something else. But
you can send us $2 and a nice little Christmas card. Yes. You can mail us a personal check. It doesn't matter.
A money order, even.
Even a money. You can go to 7-Eleven and get a money order.
That's right. Anyway, email us. We'll walk you through the whole process. We have a couple letters. Or do you want to do your DVD pick first?
The Magic Christmas Tree. It's not on DVD. It's on YouTube. It's deranged.
It is, yeah. I write about it in the book.
It's like an hour and 5 minutes. It is one of the weirdest, most occult children's Christmas films that has ever existed.
Plus an effeminate talking Christmas tree.
Indeed, an effeminate talking Christmas tree. I don't know how anyone could resist the allure of that. And so The Magic Christmas Tree, it's from the 60s, mm-hmm. late 50s, early 60s.
Early 60s.
It is rotten, and it is astounding.
We'll post the YouTube link on our page, on the Linoleum Knife Podcast page.
All right, we're going to do one letter this week, because we're running long.
All right.
All right. This is from Matt.
Is this the letter about the commentary? You should read the letter about the commentary.
Hang on. Okay, this is the letter about the commentary from Eric.
Thank you.
We'll get to yours next week, Matt. All right, this is from Eric. Loving the White Christmas podcast a lot. I'm attaching a couple of White Christmases that have the prologue that he's attached to audio tracks.
The beginning of the song.
Yeah. I never took it as jokey or a parody. I simply heard it as, "Aw, I'm not in a place that gets snow at Christmas." And that is a way you can take it.
But that's how you can perform it.
That wasn't his intention. Right. His intention was to write a sort of tongue-in-cheek
reminiscence
song. Yeah. One is the Divine Marilyn Horn. The other is an a cappella girl group called Inner Voices. Movie notes. I love the part where after Mandy, the song, the number Mandy in White Christmas, Betty says to Judy, "Honey, was the tempo too slow here?" and plays Mandy, "There's a Minister Handy," which of course occurs about 700 times in the number. Which one is she talking about?
Good point.
If Judy is really doing all the numbers in the show that we see her do in the rehearsal, she's going to be effing exhausted by the end of the night. She'll be doubled over in pain by the time of the White Christmas finale.
Also true.
Also true. And here's a thing where I was wrong, factually, and you were right.
Uh-huh.
Yes, Alonzo, Betty's rising line in Love You Didn't Do Right By Me is setting up a key change.
Ha, told you.
I'm sorry. By the way, I played in the orchestra for a New York City Gay Men's Chorus concert at Carnegie Hall, !, where one of their small groups did an a cappella four-part Love You Didn't Do Right By Me. That was amazing.
I bet.
There's a stage version of White Christmas that gets done around the country a lot and was done on Broadway a few years ago. It's pretty good. They make Susan the granddaughter an actual child who wants to get into show business, which gives her something to do.
Hooray!
They also make the misheard telephone conversation a little more motivated than Edna's being a busybody, which I appreciated. Merry Christmas! Eric, P.S. Have you seen Scrooge and Marley yet?
I have
not seen that. It's on Amazon streaming, a gay modern day version of A Christmas Carol. You're gonna have to convince me to watch this film. We watched it last night. Not great, but worth the time. Rusty Schwimmer's in it.
It's an interesting stab at it. I mean, just when you think you've seen every spin on A Christmas Carol, there was that whole spate of Scrooge as a ambitious career woman movie, TV movies.
Tori Spelling,
Susan Lucci, Cicely Tyson, right. Vanessa Williams. It's a gay one. It's a cool kind of take on it.
I don't like gay things.
Well, yeah, I hear you.
So I'm...
It is also one of the few... Here's the crazy thing. It's a gay movie. It's also a family-friendly movie, which you don't get very often. So that's, I don't know. There, I admire what they're trying.
I appreciate that.
I admire the goals and ambitions of this movie. It's worth a look if it sounds like something that you think you'd be interested in.
All right. Sure.
Well, you're not interested, so I don't know the
name. Not really. You
know? I want to remind everybody to check out the 12 Days of Killmas at Crave Online.
Oh, yeah.
Our friend Bibbs, William Bibbiani, on the heels of his successful Kings of Horror series, where he and his friend Ryan from Shock Till You Drop did 31 Stephen King movie adaptations in 31 Days of October. They have done the 12 Days of Killmas, so it's 12 horror movies that are related to Christmas. I appear in the first episode, plugging the book, and I die.
Yep.
So that was fun.
It's pretty great.
You should totally check it out. I think all 12 of them are going to be really fun. They have interesting things to say about the movies. They picked some cool ones. And so, yeah, that's something that people need to look at.
That's it. We're done.
Okay. Yeah. So just reminding everybody, as always, to check out ChristyLemire.com. Go to Rotten Tomatoes Radio. They had me on this week with Leonard Maltin. That was a lot of fun. Oh, check out Leonard Maltin's YouTube channel next week. I'm going to go on to talk about Christmas movies with him, which I'm very excited about because he is, you know, the dean.
He's the boss.
He is the dean of us all. Check out the Frank DeCaro show on Sirius XM. I think I'm going to be going on there soon, maybe, to talk about Christmas movies. And of course, Derek.
Oh, are you really?
Maybe. I'm not sure. It depends all on right. The schedule. Derek and Romaine, of course, we were just on again this week.
Way to hold them to it on the air now.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't even know if he listens. check out the B Movies podcast. There's a new episode of Team Jack.
Oh,
you
Jack Dorsey fans will want to know. Here's a funny thing. So Jack came over yesterday to the Christmas party. And he was in the kitchen. I was flipping pancakes, and he was talking to me. And I said, "Hey, dude, guess what? You are our most controversial guest ever." And he's like, "What do you mean?" And I was like, "Well, not a week goes by without someone emailing, texting, messaging, tweeting, either how much they think you are great and how your episode was their favorite, or how much they hate you, wish you would die, and they will stop listening to the podcast should we ever have you on again." And he was actually a little bit sort of stunned at first, but I was like, no, this means you're great. This means if you are, not only did people love you and or hate you, but they responded to you.
Yeah, like they cared enough to drop us a line.
We have guests, and people are sort of like, it's like a tree that fell in the forest. Yeah. Like, yeah, okay, sure, that was fine.
Manola Dargis was on this show and didn't generate that kind of email.
I know, yeah. We had the Manola Dargis on our show. Talking about Christmas movies last year, and I don't think anyone responded at all. And so, you know, and what I told him was, it's a good thing that you are being loved and hated in equal measure.
Yes.
In fact, just this week, I got a pro-Jack and an anti-Jack message on Facebook. And one day, he'll be back again.
Like it or not.
Sorry, haters. Sorry, Jack haters. One day we'll bring him back.
In the meantime, you can check out...
maybe you'll learn to love him.
You can check out the new episode of Team Jack. Check out The Lunch, James Rocky's podcast. I was on last week, right after the LAFCA meeting. He and I and Amy Nicholson and Karina Longworth talked about the winners and losers and how we felt about how everything went down. And, you know, check out all the other shows that I always mention every week. I
don't know all of those. Economy,
and we are running long this
tons
week.
Of them, yeah.
Thanks for listening, as always, and we will catch you next time.
Goodbye.